This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Good day. Welcome to New Books in History, a podcast channel on New Books Network. My name is Dr. Charles Cotillo of the Royal Historical Society. I'm a host on the channel. And today we are pleased and indeed honored to have with us Master Historian Professor Jeremy Black. Professor Black is Professor Emeritus in the Department of History at Exeter University. He is without a doubt the most prolific historian writing in the Anglophone world today. And today we are discussing one of his latest books, The Age of Nightmare, The Gothic and British Culture, 1750 to 1900, published by St. Augustine's Press. Welcome, Professor Black.
Hello.
Professor, what is the thesis of your book?
What I'm trying to do is to look at the literature and more generally culture of Britain in this period to try and show that alongside the other themes we tend to foreground, that in practice there was also a sustained interest in the neo-Gothic, and through that in what I've called an age of nightmare. And I've looked at that in two particular lights, both focusing on works in which evil is a real presence, satanic often, and also those in which evil is a device of wicked human beings.
What was meant by the term Gothic in the first half of the 18th century in Great Britain?
Well, Gothic, as in terms of the first half of the 18th century in Britain, was largely an architectural device with reference to particular interests in medieval, or what was seen as medievalism, to wit, castles, to wit, the culture of that period as it was understood, Geoffrey Chaucer, for example. And it didn't act that stage have any relationship to a concern about the strange, the exotic, let alone the occult.
What was the first Gothic novel of note, and who wrote it?
The first Gothic novel of note is The Castle of Otranto by Horace Walpole, who eventually becomes 4th Earl of Orford, and who is the alleged son, in practical terms, he was illegitimate, of Sir Robert Walpole, the first Earl of Orford, who had been Prime Minister. And The Castle of Otranto comes out in 1764. Its second edition is subtitled A Gothic Story. And it's about Otranto in remote Apulia in Italy. It's about a sort of story set in the medieval period in which there is a supernatural being that takes action in order to offset evil. And I think it's fairly clear-cut to say that it was very dramatically different to fiction at the time. It begins energetically. There's an ancient prophecy. There's then an interrupted marriage in which the son of the Prince of Otranto is destroyed under an enormous helmet, which is, we're told, 100 times larger than one for any human. And this helmet is identified as one that was on a statue of a famed medieval ruler. And what it is it's an attempt to of good to, of providence more specifically, to punish Manfred, the Prince of Otranto, who is held up to be a evil person.
Would it be true to say...
And you see, there's this... Sorry, and just, I mean, to give you, I just pick out a passage here from the Castle of Otranto. It provides a kind of idea of subterranean mystery. So here's a passage. The lower part of the castle was hollowed into several intricate cloisters, and it was not easy for one under so much anxiety to found the door that opened into the cavern. An awful silence reigned throughout these subterranean regions, except now and then some blasts of wind that shook the doors she had passed, and which grating on the rusty hinges were re-echoed through that long labyrinthine of darkness. A ray of moonshine streaming through a cranny of the ruin above shone directly on the lock they sought. The trapdoor beneath appeared some stone steps descending into a vault totally dark. So, you know, in other words, we've got a truly terrifying setting with these sinister underground passages, with strange crimes, with the clap of thunder that instant shook the castle to its foundations. The earth rocked and the clank of more than mortal armor was heard behind, and so on and so forth.
Would it be true to say that Walpole's novel heavily influenced subsequent exercises in the genre?
It's very true to say that, Charles. That's spot on. And I think what you could say also is the gothic shadows that Walpole put to the fore very much lengthen under his successors. And his most famous successors, if the 1790s, are Anna Radcliffe, whose most famous novel is probably The Mysteries of Udolpho, which of course is satirized by Jane Austen in Northanger Abbey, and also so-called Monk Lewis, whose novel The Monk actually introduces Satan into the story.
Is there a sociological or materialist explanation for the rise of the Gothic novel in the second half of the 18th century in Great Britain?
Well, I suppose there is, and I discuss that in my book. And I mean, you could argue that it's sort of a concern about commercialism, concern about change. You could argue that it's a reflection about anxieties, political anxieties, so that in part it's reaching back to the idea that there was an old order of virtue and value that has been subverted by modern wiggery, and subsequently that is being challenged by revolutionary enthusiasm in the case of the French Revolution, which to some of its commentators, as I discuss in the book, appears to be almost depicting an age of terror and a sort of adamantine breaking of the earth's surface. So I think, yes, you could put material circumstances, and you could also say, well, it's sold. I mean, Anna Radcliffe in the 1790s, I mean, she produces 6 novels and retires at 32, having made a fortune. And, you know, it's all very well for Jane Austen to make fun of her. I mean, it's worth saying that Anna Radcliffe outsold Jane Austen many, many, many times. So clearly, there is also the commercial... the commercial appeal, and I have a chapter in Anne's Shadows in which I went through, it took me a hell of a long time to do so, some of the more obscure works, which, you know, some marvellous titles, The Animated Skeleton, for example, in which a lot of, shall we say, lesser writers, I don't mean to be pejorative, but I think most of us would see them as lesser writers, cashed in on it. And obviously found that this was the way to do it. Or Edgar, or The Phantom of the Castle, which was written by Richard Sicklemore, not a household name, 1798. It includes a castle usurper and a skeleton, all of which are fairly usual. Edgar, by the light of lightning, descends the staircase and then goes through a passage in, quote, impenetrable darkness, past an iron door, into an underground room poorly lit by a lamp, which, quote, spread a tremulous gleam more horrible than darkness itself. And, you know, he ends up alarmed by violent and uncommon noise, absorbed in silent terror, etc., etc., etc. Or the following year, Thomas Curtis, Ethelwinda, 1799. So you've got the use of potions, imprisonment in a dungeon, the threat of rape. The scenario includes an armor-clad ghost bearing a bloody sword. You know, these are the standard kind of themes, and, you know, I discuss these. I found some of the novels quite difficult to get a copy of, but I discuss these, and sometimes they're satirized. So, for example, in 1797, as somebody offers a recipe for a novel of this type, take an old castle, half of it ruinous, a long gallery with a great many doors, some secret ones, three murdered bodies quite fresh, as many skeletons in chests and presses, an old woman hanging by the neck with her throat cut, assassins and desperadoes, noises, whispers and groans, three scores at least. Mix them together in the form of three volumes to be taken at any of the watering places before going to bed.
Were Gothic novels popular on the continent?
Yes, Gothic novels were very popular on the continent, particularly in Germany. And in fact, there are some of the Gothic novels in Britain are actually anglicisations of German forms. Matthew Lewis, who I've already mentioned, who wrote The Monk, had been to Germany, was fascinated by German culture, in fact. Interestingly enough, Lewis also, he met key literary figures in Weimar, for example, and translated Wieland zu Oberon, in which there's a magic horn, a magic ring, the spirit world, all play a role. Lewis became a member of Parliament, and his the Monk, which is a pretty over the top a work, led to him getting into real trouble politically. So I think it's fair to say there was an Anglo-German theme. I mean, you can see it in Gluck, you can see it in Weber, you know, the Freischütz. I mean, it's very much, you can see it in the paintings of Caspar David Friedrich. I have a chapter on Susie, who's Swiss, but, you know, part of the German world, who comes to Britain. And my original choice for the cover was his painting The Dream, which is a very disturbing one. I'm afraid, you know, one needs to pay too much money to get the rights to reproduce that. But, you know, yes, it was in many senses an Anglo-German intellectual movement.
And it would be true to say that the popularity of Gothic novels in the second half of the 18th century was part and parcel of a popularity of medieval themes and imagery.
Yes, very much. There was a strong medievalism you see in literature as a whole, you see in painting, you see in the Shakespeare cult, which was very much a Gothic cult of that period, not least the way in which Macbeth, for example, is very much put on the stage and in painting and is referred to in literature. No, I think you're absolutely right to see this. You know, people talk about the cult of the future and the Enlightenment. They need to understand that the Enlightenment had very many facets, as indeed did Romanticism.
How did Shakespeare and his popularity tie in with the Gothic novel?
Well, Shakespeare was very much enjoyed a vogue in the late 18th century. I mean, this is the age of Garrick, of course. And I think what is fair to say is that the Shakespeare that people were particularly interested in was often the Shakespeare of the medieval period, and also the magical Shakespeare. And as I've said, I mean, Macbeth is the classic example of that. But also, for example, King Lear is very much seen in these lights. Fuseli, who I've already mentioned, produced a massive Macbeth and the Witches, which was painted in the late 1780s. He produced A Lady Macbeth Sleepwalking, which came out in the early 1780s. Shakespeare was staged also in the Shakespeare Gallery in London in the 1790s, which displayed a lot of Shakespeare's plays, through paintings. And it was very, very frequent to see references to Shakespeare and echoes of him in terms of the neo-Gothic writers.
How would you compare Anne Radcliffe with Horace Walpole in terms of stylistically as Gothic novelists?
Well, Anne Radcliffe, shall we say, is more verbose. I think it's fair to say that Horace Walpole's novel is short, it's to the point, and it stops before you get fed up with it. I think it's fair to say that Anne Radcliffe, she very rarely will use three words if 15 will do for her. But on the other hand, you get the standard theme. So, the Mysteries of Udolpho. They were surprised by the appearance of a light through the broken window shutters of an apartment belonging to a division of the castle, which for many years had been shut up. They were engaged in interesting discourse when Madoc, who was then speaking, was interrupted by a low, hollow sound which arose from beneath the apartment and seemed like the closing of a door. Chilled into a silence, they listened and distinctly heard it repeated. Deadly ideas crowded upon their imagination and inspired a terror which scarcely allowed them to breathe, and so on and so forth.
Jeremy, you're a very good conveyor of Gothic novels.
Let me tell you, Gothic novels, obviously people only read them, but actually, if you were to spend your time reading them aloud, some of them are absolutely fantastic.
How was the Gothic novel influenced, if at all, by the French Revolution?
Well, I think the Gothic novel is very much influenced by the French Revolution, because I think the French Revolution leads to a strong sense of terror. And terror, after all, is, with the sublime, is what people are trying to throw to the fore. For example, let's see if we can find this comes from the Old English Baronet, which is a neo-Gothic novel. He refers to the writer refers to an ignorant and depraved mob. Popular energy is ever most obedient to the vicious, even ready to destroy rather than to create, to condemn than to absolve. And hence we have seen that in all countries nothing is so absurd, nothing so impolitic, unjust, or horribly atrocious, that the dictator of the day can order or invite to, but a blind and furious populace will concur and aid in the perpetuation of it. In other words, what one has got is there is got a absolute terror of the public and the way in which they can be brutal. So you've got here a Sicilian romance. A dark abyss for the murdered bodies of the unfortunate people who had fallen into the hands of the banditti. The bodies which remained unburied exhibited a spectacle too shocking for humanity, this mansion of the murdered. Or Matthew Lewis in The Monk produces a description of a riot in Madrid, which is clearly lifted straight out of accounts from the English press of the riots in the French Revolution. The people forced a passage through the guards who protected their destined victim, dragged her from her shelter, and proceeded to take upon her a most summary and cruel vengeance. He did nothing but the gratification of their barbarous vengeance, loaded her with mud and filth, dragged her through the streets, trampling her and treating her with every species of cruelty, exercised their impotent rage upon her lifeless body. They beat it, trod upon it, and ill-used it, till it became no more than a mass of flesh. Unsightly, shapeless, and disgusting. I mean, this is very much how the French Revolution was seen.
Why were so many Gothic novels situated, in Italy?
Oh, well, Italy had this sense of, first of all, literally, and the ruins from the past, the ruins both of medievalism, the Gothic, but also looking back to antiquity. There's the sense of degeneracy that is very strongly you focused on Italy, the idea that the Catholic Church is degenerate, the idea that Italy is the country of sodomy. Britain doesn't tend to be seen as the country of sodomy till the boarding school cult of the late 19th century. So for 18th century Brits, it's Italy that is the country of sodomy. And also the belief that Italy is a place of strange crimes. If you go back to, for example, Elizabethan and Jacobean revenge tragedies, plays like The Revenger's Tragedy or The Duchess of Malfi, Italy is the place of murderers, of poisons and garrottings and all the rest of it. So it proves the perfect setting for this. And also the first and most famous one, as I've already mentioned, is the Castle of Otranto. So if you want to repeat it, you repeat it. I mean, as you may know, as I mentioned in my book, Horace Walpole himself tells a joke, I didn't even know there was a Castle of Otranto. Well, you know, he visited Naples in 1740. He probably would have known what was in Otranto. But the point is that he, as it were, had set the staging for it. So you've got a lot of the, as you say, of the very famous novels, The Italian, for example, by Anna Radcliffe, self-evidently in Italy. Though, as I've said, The Monk, which I have mentioned, is set in Spain. But then Spain, again, draws on this same sense of anti-Catholicism, this same sense that the Mediterranean cultures are in some respects more decadent.
Would it be true to say that there was decline in the Gothic novel after 1810?
It would be very true to say that, or equally, as I've tried to show, and I did have to plow through a lot of stuff, it's also true to say there were many Gothic novels after 1810. I have this, chapter Forgotten Decade, for example, and I think it's fair to say that there are a large number of novels that go on and that, you know, that obviously are formulaic, and then, in a sense, also influence what comes afterwards. So one of the arguments I make is that the Gothic is a theme underlying a lot of what we see as Victorian fiction, whether it's Charlotte Bronte's Jane Eyre, which is 1848, presenting a sort of mystery at Thornfield Hall, one of secret rooms, insanity and control, and very much looking a lot of themes of the neo-Gothic, whether it's Edgar Allan Poe's Fall of the House of Usher, 1839, whether it's, for that matter, Edward Bulwer-Lytton's The Last Days of Pompeii, 1834, which is one of the most popular novels of its age, which is, you know, a corrupt religious cult with a character who is straight out, the Egyptian sorcerer and high priest of Isis, he's straight out of Gothic fiction. Whether it's Dickens with The Mystery of Edwin Drood in 1870, and again set in Cloisterham, which is modelled on, a fictional place, modelled on Rochester, Kent, an old cathedral place. There's A Strange Murder, Fog, The Dark is Feared, etc., etc., etc. You know, it's very much a Gothic setting, compounded by the fact that it's an unfinished novel. And, you know, there are a lot of the Victorian fiction, I argue, which looks to, I would say, the same of Wilkie Collins. And then there are less famous novels, but which look to these themes. And then, you know, towards the end, I discuss at greater length both Dracula, which is 1897, in which, of course, evil is encapsulated. It's the power of a living past, which is a standard theme of Gothic novels, with dreamlike images and episodes absolutely central to the narrative. And again, there's a strange castle, there's a figure who isn't what he seems to be. I think that's a fair description of Dracula. There is the struggle between good and evil. There is the quote undead. You know, it's all very, very, very much. I mean, this comes from Dracula attacking Wilhelmina Harker. With his left hand, he held both Mrs. Harker's hands. keeping them away with her arms at full tension. His right hand gripped her by the back of the neck, forcing her face down on his bosom. Her white neck nightdress was smeared with blood, and a thin stream trickled down the man's bare breast, which was shown by his torn open dress. His eyes flamed red with devilish passion. The great nostrils of the white aquiline nose opened wide and quivered at the edge, and the white sharp teeth behind the full lips of the blood-dripping mouth champed together like those of a wild beast. Well, I think it's fair to say this is gothic at a really, terrifying fashion, and it has to be held at bay by Van Hessling being able to use the sacred wafer, being able to use crucifixes, that it's very much good versus evil. Van Hessling provides a gloss on evolution in terms of a struggle between humans and Dracula, with God playing a key role, and all the idea of the earth boxes and all the rest of it. Now, Sherlock Holmes is different, and I contrast Dracula with the Hound of the Baskervilles, which does have a dreamlike quality and does have sinister events, but there is a real purpose behind those, a real person, not a diabolical person behind it. It isn't a monstrous hound, it's a large hound which has been done by Stapleton so that it appears to be sinister. And of course, Conan Doyle goes on in later Holmes stories, such as Shoscombe Old Place, which comes out in 1927, to have real settings in the Gothic. So that's the Berkshire Gothic. You get What Is Master Doing Down at the Old Church Crypt at Night, The Haunted Crypt, an old ruined chapel in the park. Under it, there's a crypt which has a bad name of Balgus among us, so on and so forth. And, they examine the graves, and there turns out to be a rational explanation. Or again, in The Sussex Vampire of 1924, Holmes takes aim at the belief in vampires. Remember, Conan Doyle believes in other forms of the supernatural, but not in vampires. What are we to do with walking corpses who could only be held in their grave by stakes driven through their hearts? It's pure lunacy. That's Holmes, as you might imagine. Watson is not the same, but it's more willing to give credit to it. But I think it's fair to say that you capture by that stage, and it goes on into the present day, or the more present day. You've got, for example, Fantasy Fright in things like Philip Pullman's trilogy, His Dark Materials, which is 1995 to 2000. Do you got The Lord of the Rings by J.R.R. Tolkien, The One Ring to Rule Them All, Mordor, The Dominion of the Evil Sauron. That's straight out of Gothic fiction. I mean, listen to this one. His eye, piercing all shadows, looked across the plain. At his summons, wheeling with a rending cry, in a last desperate race, there flew faster than the wind. The winds, the Nazgul, the Ringwraiths, and with a storm of wings, they hurtled southwards to Mount Doom. Now, I can tell you this, Dracula would have loved to have had the power of Sauron. Or you can have, just before that, for a previous generation, The Devil Rides Out, which came out in 1934. So that's before me. But I can remember when it came out as a film, which was 1968, and the plot focuses on a devil-worshipping cult able to call up the angel of death, etc., 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 etc. And the wise hero in that, the Duke of Ishvia, hammers out, despite our electricity, our aeroplanes, our modern scepticism, the power of darkness is still a living force, worshipped by depraved human beings for their unholy ends in the great cities of Europe and America to this very day. Agatha Christie, as I tried to show in my book, The Pursuit of Poirot, also published by St. Augustine, also has this belief in the real presence of evil. Makes masses of references to the Bible in the sort of idea of the religious struggle. So what you've got here is a discussion, if you want to put it like that, about the real presence of evil, the way in which you could argue that as conventional Christianity moved in, or conventional Protestantism moved in a more, whatever you want to call it, direction, self-consciously rationalist direction, so that didn't satisfy many others. Now, you could say that, I don't know. I mean, it's interesting to note that Catholicism, which has Marianology as a clearly, shall we say, not self-consciously rational pursuit from the late 19th century, does not show the same degree of fascination with the equivalent of the neo-Gothic.
What was the first Gothic novel to feature a vampire?
Oh, dear me. That's a good one. I've actually discussed that in my book, and I'd have to go back and remind myself. So you tell me. You've read it more recently than me, because I read it 2 years ago when I read all these things 2 years ago when I was writing it. You tell me, Charles.
I don't remember the name of the author, but it came out, I believe, in the immediate aftermath of the Battle of Waterloo. So you're talking about sometime between 1810 and 1820.
Yes, I think that's about right. I mean, there was a vampires themselves, incidentally, there was a lot of interest in vampires in the mid 18th century. I remember reading, when I was doing work on newspapers from the 1730s in both Paris and London, reporting vampirism in Hungary and Transylvania, and trying to find a rationalization from it. I actually think it's earlier than after Waterloo, thinking about it. There's a very influential German ballad, Lenora, L-E-N-O-R-E, which is, I think, 1773, by Gottfried Bulger. That's got vampires in. And the Southey in his The Old Woman of Berkeley, which I think is 1799, which is a ballad, he has a vampiric witch. So I would say vampires are, shall we say, already present in the late 18th century, but becoming more common in the 1790s, 1800s. Lewis, who I've mentioned, you know, the chap that writes The Monk, he produces an anthology, Tales of Wonder, which comes out in 1801. And in that, he anthologizes Southey's The Old Woman of Berkeley. So, I mean, if you'd read Tales of Wonder, you would already have been familiar with the idea of vampires.
How unique was Bram Stoker's employment of a vampire in his novel Dracula?
Well, I wouldn't say he was unique, but what I would say is he takes it at a particular scale and does so with, I would argue, some success. I mean, I think it's really quite frightening, and I think it's fair to say that the sexual side is really quite potent. So now, I wouldn't say he's unique. I would say that he actually brings together the previous theme. If you go back, as I've already mentioned, to the 18th century, Voltaire writes condemning the idea of vampires, which presupposes that there was quite a knowledge of them. I mean, Voltaire specifically is referring to a book by a French clergyman, Augustine Calmet, but you know, it's clearly there. And again, if you look in Britain, a chap called John Polidori produces The Vampire, a Tale, which comes out in 1819. Byron produces what he calls a fragment, which has vampirism in it. And there's Varney the Vampire, or The Feast of Blood, by James Rymer of 1847, which is, you know, I mean, quite a popular work. And Sheridan Le Fanu's Carmilla, which is 1872. Now, in Byron's A Fragment, it's not as sustained as Polidori's The Vampire, but it's all about vampirism coming into the elite, and that's very much a theme of Varney the Vampire, in which Sir Francis Varney is a member of the elite and has fangs, he has hypnotic abilities, he has great strength, he leaves puncture wounds, and he can approach his female victims, and somehow they always seem interested in female victims, by coming in through the night through windows. So I think a lot of what you might associate with Dracula is already there. What I would say is it's given a big twist forward, partly because of Stoker's imagination, partly because of the Jack the Ripper killings of 1888, which I think increased concern about crime against women and a fascination with strange crimes, and partly by the, you know, the clearly sexual dimension. I mean, if you, I don't know if you've read Dracula, it kicks off with Jonathan Harker going on a rail journey. You know, he's got this strange commission, so he goes to Transylvania in response to this invitation by Dracula, and he has bad dreams, and in Dracula's castle, and you know, he is approached by three young women by moonlight. Well, listen to this one. The fair girl bent over me fairly gloating. There was a deliberate voluptuousness which was both thrilling and repulsive. And as she arched her neck, she actually licked her lips like an animal, till I could see in the moonlight the moisture shining on the scarlet lips and on the red tongue as it lapped the white sharp teeth. I closed my eyes in a languorous ecstasy and waited with beating heart. Well, I think it's fair to say if you've read Varney the Vampire, it's not quite got that sexual drive. I think we could say that, I think, fairly and safely.
Yes. Do you adhere to the theory that the interest in vampires as such originated in those lands in the 1720s, which were acquired by Austria from the Ottoman Turks, and that subsequently it came west?
Yes, I think there is a lot of truth in that. I mean, obviously, we have to be very careful of understanding what is the a causal pattern. But yes, I think that's a very, very, very fair assumption about that in a way, it's the eruption is the wrong word, but it's the movement into Western consciousness of a series of ideas which had been more pronounced further east. It's not that there hadn't been an occult in the West. There had been. Obviously, you can just think for a kickoff about, you know, concern about witchcraft in England and Scotland in the 16th and 17th century. But I think the specific movement of vampirism is one that, yes, I would agree with you in that geographical transfer.
What is the difference between a gothic novel and a sensation novel?
Well, I think it's fair to say that there isn't a hard and fast difference. I would say the gothic novel is different more because of what it actually chooses to focus on. You know, if you like, the actual settings of the gothic. I think it is important. You know, I read out those comments about the people made about, you know, you have to have a monastery and you have to have the dark and all the rest of it. There are sensational novels, but they don't necessarily have to have the same medievalism, the same castle setting. The Gothic novel, after all, can be satirized. I mean, in Sheridan's play, the critic Puff refers to when a heroine goes mad, she always goes into white satin. And there is that interest in madness in the Gothic. Whereas a sensation novel, everybody can be absolutely sane, and it can be something like the attempted abduction of an heiress. But it doesn't necessarily have to have any... you know, it can be villainy without being evil, if that's a distinction that makes sense.
If you wanted people to take one thing away from your book, Professor Black, what would it be?
Oh, that these are really interesting and important novels, and that this, I'm afraid to say, because, you know, it shouldn't be the case, but this is the best guide to them available, because I've looked at both the famous ones, and including ones we haven't discussed, like Frankenstein, but I've also spent a long time doing research onto what I might call more obscure and forgettable novels, but which nevertheless contribute to the extent to which these themes and the themes of this literature was readily available across culture in the late 18th and 19th century.
On that observation, I would like to thank you very much, Professor Black, for being so kind as to speak with us today. This is Charles Cotillo. You've been listening to New Books in History, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. Thank you, Professor Black, very much.
Thank you very much.